episode 41 of Did You Bring the Hummus podcast. I'm Kimberly, your host, and I'm super excited to be here with you today. Did You Bring the Hummus is a podcast to help you go vegan. This season, I'm sharing new episodes every Monday discussing all things vegan. Most importantly, we'll talk about how to embrace this meaningful decision with fervor and fun. Episodes post every Monday on your favorite podcast app. Before we get started, I have one very important question for you. Did you bring the hummus? Did you know that I offer one-on-one coaching? If you've found inspiration in these episodes but want more accountability or help guiding you through exploring a vegan lifestyle, check out my website for more information. In the last episode, I challenged you to check the label on your favorite household or beauty product. Is it cruelty-free and vegan? And the week before, to try out some plant milks. How's it going? Did you find products in your home which have been tested on animals? What's your favorite plant milk so far? This week, let's go a little bit deeper. After listening, choose one of the 6 reasons or Jewish mandates Richard gave for going vegan and do some of your own research as to why consuming or using animals violates that mandate. Sure, this feels a little bit like homework, but Richard did work as a professor, so I think it's fitting. Then send me an email at didyoubringthehummus@gmail.com or post your findings on the Instagram or Facebook post for this episode to get a conversation started. I can't wait to chat with you. Today, I am joined by Richard H. Schwartz, PhD, who is the author of Vegan Revolution, Saving Our World, Revitalizing Judaism, Judaism and Vegetarianism, Judaism and Global Survival, Who Stole My Religion, Revitalizing Judaism, and Applying Jewish Values to Help Heal Our Imperiled Planet, and Mathematics and Global Survival, as well as over 250 related articles at jewishveg.org/Schwartz. He is President Emeritus of Jewish Veg, Associate Producer of the video A Sacred Duty, Applying Jewish Values to Help Heal the World, and Professor Emeritus at the College of Staten Island, New York. A father, grandfather, and now great-grandfather, he has, since 2016, lived with his wife in Israel. In this episode, Richard shares 6 mandates to go vegan, discusses climate change, the effects of eating animals has on our bodies, and much, much more. Oh, and if keeping kosher is important to you, stay tuned because we get into that too. Hey, Richard. Thank you so much for joining me here today.
Okay, it's my pleasure, and kudos for all the wonderful work you're doing, and best wishes for continued success.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And same to you. My goodness, have you been on a mission for a long time, sharing the vegan message and encouraging all of us to make better choices and to show up in the world in a kinder, more compassionate way. How about we get started with sharing your vegan journey? How did it all begin?
Okay, actually, it all started when I was teaching mathematics at the College of Staten Island. And one of the courses I was teaching was for liberal arts non-science students. They were going to arts and music and all. So they weren't exactly very interested in math, but well prepared. They had to take one math course to meet a degree requirement. So in order to motivate them, I came up with this idea of giving a course on mathematics and the environment. And basic math relating to what's happening in the world. One year there was a conference on world hunger, tied it in with that, and I just felt, well, unfortunately, not enough food in the world. Then I read this wonderful book by Francis Maurepay. You may be familiar with Diet for a Small Planet. I know that's influenced many, many people. And it pointed out how wasteful animal-based diets were. Like, for example, 70% of grain produced in the U.S. was fed to animals to fatten them up for slaughter at a time when millions of people were dying of hunger. So that sort of got me started, and then reading more and more about it, and the case seemed so strong, I felt that I can write a book about it. And that's where that Judaism and Vegetarianism book came from. There were so many good books, but nothing on that. So, after we'd have discussions in the class about how we can reduce hunger, and I mentioned many, many times how shifting away from animal-based diets would make a difference. After a few semesters of that, I took my own advice, slowly but surely gave up cold cuts and red meat, et cetera, et cetera. Became a vegetarian about 1977. And slowly but surely became a vegan like in about 2000. And that's the basic story.
Thank you. You know, I have to say, I wish that I had been able to take your math class, because as a non-math person, I'll say, I wouldn't have had to retake calculus twice in order to fulfill my math requirement if I'd been able to take your math class, because that definitely would have been a much easier way for me to relate numbers to the world and things that mattered to me. So, how amazing. What an incredible thought to create a class like that, to make it this important information accessible to students that wouldn't necessarily be able to get into it the way that they were. Look at that. From the very start, you've been finding a way to make us better stewards of the world, even through math. Who would have thought? So you also have a focus within Judaism, like you mentioned, the Judaism and vegetarianism. How did you start to tie that together? Because, you know, as we know, we hear people all the time quoting from the Bible or the Torah saying, and maybe, you know, of course, correct me if I'm misusing any words or anything, where they're like, no, God says we're supposed to eat these animals. They were given to us by God. So it's in the book, read it. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Okay. Actually, in the very first chapter of the Jewish Bible, the Torah, chapter 1, verse 29, God's first dietary regimen, strictly vegan. So it talks about the herbs of the field, the fruit of the tree, etc. So that there's a very strong beginning on that. And later on, after the flood, where much of the vegetation was destroyed, permission was given, but always was a concession. It was the meat associated with lust and all, and much more favorable to the so-called seven species, with dates and figs and honey from the dates and all. So vegetarian foods looked on much more favorably. So the beginning, but also in the ideal time that Jews yearned for, the Messianic period, that will also, like the Garden of Eden, the initial ideal time, that Messianic period will also be vegan, based on the powerful words of Isaiah, that in that ideal time, the wolf will dwell with the lamb, the lion will be eat straw with the ox, no one shall hurt nor destroy in all God's holy mountain. And in addition, I found six very important, powerful Jewish mandates that point to veganism as the ideal Jewish diet. And these, very briefly, and then I can go in much more detail later, of course, to take care of our health, to treat animals with compassion, to protect the environment, to conserve natural resources, to help hungry people, and to seek and pursue peace. These are all very fundamental. It's not like some 13th century rabbi said, and I had a dig for that, but this is fundamental to Judaism.
That's awesome. I love that it's right there and we can point to it.
Many, many powerful quotes on that in the Bible, again, about taking care of our health, preserving the environment, etc.
You know, I have to say, so my family was raised Catholic. Like, my parents were both raised Catholic, but we found out through 23andMe for sure that we have some Jewish ancestry on my father's side. And it's interesting because I'd always kind of been drawn to religion without being drawn to the religiousness of it. And I love reading the books and hearing the stories and talking through what it all means, but I never felt tied to a religion. In fact, as a small child, I kind of declared myself atheist without even knowing what that word meant. But I would tell my mom, like, I was bored at church and God's not real and I've got better storybooks at home. Can we just go home? And then I became kind of an angry atheist in my like teens, where I kind of felt like people who believed in religion, like there must be something wrong with them because that's ridiculous that they would like give themselves over to this thing that there's no proof of. And there was a lot, I got a lot of emotion around those things, right? But as I got into college and I started really, and my degree is actually in philosophy and religion, but as I was learning and reading and starting to like embrace these stories from these different books and kind of understanding where it's all coming from, I started to wonder this feel. And I read it in your latest book too, where it was almost like people are following these books for the sake of doing the actions or the rituals or the traditions without looking at the way the world is now and questioning the way it's written and how we can apply it and what it really means.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is what my favorite rabbi, Abraham Joshua Heschel, calls religious behaviorism.
Mm-hmm.
So, emotions in effect, but not connecting to the world. That is why one of the books that I've written is called Who Stole My Religion? Because I argue that Judaism, probably like other religions, is a radical religion in the best sense of that term. Such strong teachings on compassion that I build my case for vegetarianism and veganism on pursuing justice. Matter of fact, only two things in Judaism are told to pursue. One is justice, the other one is peace. Mm. And 36 times in the Torah, the verse that occurs most often indicates, be kind to the stranger, do not oppress the stranger. And that is the story that the Jews were slaves in Egypt. And one of the reasons of that is that we should know what it's like to be an outsider, to be a stranger, to be alienated, so that we look on the stranger and make a difference. So, as I said, who stole my religion? Powerful ideas, but very often religious people who should be the pioneers in speaking out against the status quo when it's not just, are accepting it all too often. It's a ritual that governs. But the Jewish prophets, perhaps the greatest champions of social justice in the world's history, spoke out and, challenged kings and priests and princes and all, and said, this is not what God wants. They did have the biblical sacrifices, unfortunately, but that was, even there was a step forward. That was a common mode of worship in biblical times. And in Judaism, it was put into one central location, the idea to wean it off, to use off of that. And the prophets indicated that God's primary concern was justice and mercy, and that actually sacrifice could be an abomination to God if not carried out along with acts of justice and mercy.
Mm. I recently read a definition of sacrifice that, where it was kind of like we took that phrase too literally, that it wasn't the need to take a life in honor of God or to give over to God or in order to avoid something happening, that more of it's this idea that we constantly have things we're doing or emotions we're feeling that aren't serving us any longer. And that's a phrase that's very popular right now, right? Things that don't serve us anymore. But to kind of put it in terms that maybe people can relate to, but we have these things that we hold on to so tightly because it's what we've always done, it's who we think we are, it's what's always been, and the sacrifice is to let it go because that allows us to be who we truly are, to embrace that peace and that justice and maybe being better stewards of the world. So I don't know what you think about that, but to me, I like that interpretation of a sacrifice, of giving up something that we know we don't need anymore in order to allow in the goodness and to give ourselves over to others and take care of each other in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, as I said, according to the prophets, it was mercy and justice that are the more important things. And putting things into practice is like a so-called midrash or rabbinic study that says that when God created the world, it took Adam, the first human being, to see the beauties of God's creation, the trees in the Garden of Eden, and he said, do not despoil or destroy this world, for if you do, there will be nobody after you to restore it. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, maybe for thousands of years, people wondered, what are they talking about? Can we possibly destroy the world? But as you know now, with climate change and other environmental threats, it's all too possible. And that is what I've been pushing, promoting the most, that there's no way we can possibly avert a climate catastrophe without a major, almost societal shift toward vegan diets. And luckily, that is much easier today because, as you know, they have plant-based substitutes which have the texture, appearance, and taste so close to the animal, the meat and other animal products, that even long-time meat eaters can't make a difference. So this is the bottom line today because, as you know, more and more dire warnings from climate experts and increased frequency of heat waves, storms and floods, droughts, wildfires. So this is why it's urgent that there be a shift, major shift to plant-based diets, and it's essential to get that message out. And so happy that you're giving me this opportunity to try to get it to a wider audience.
Yeah, absolutely. I am happy to talk about that. I too agree that there needs to be a major shift, and the way that we do things now, it's not sustainable. And I think even the most staunch meat eater, if they really look at it, they put their emotions aside over being told what they should eat or that their traditions can't continue in the same way anymore. And by the way, like, if you love cheeseburgers and that's a tradition for you, like, we've got plenty of vegan cheeseburgers that are amazing. to have this, to have everyone just kind of look at the truth, which seems so hard for some people, how do we get them? And maybe for people who are religious, we can use the books to show them, but in kind of a general sense, what are your thoughts on how we get people to be open to this major shift that we all need to make right now in order to save our planet?
Well, you know, everybody's concerned about children, grandchildren, even great-grandchildren, what kind of future world are we going to leave for them? And it's heading for, it's almost like the possibility of an extinction of humanity, because we've seen that in some, even today, tremendous flooding in New Zealand. Pakistan, one-third was flooded. Wildfires out in California, et cetera. And there's something that you're probably familiar with, the idea of self-reinforcing positive feedback loops, possibly leading toward an irreversible tipping point where things spin out of control. So we have to convince people, if they want a decent world for future generations, it's essential to shift toward the plant-based diets. Again, one of the excuses they would use and say, everything you say sounds okay, however, I just love that taste too much, I just can't give it up. But as indicated, they now can get that same taste with plant-based substitutes, and there's such an abundance of fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, legumes. There's far more foods in the plant kingdom than the animal kingdom. So somehow we have to get that essential message out, and I hope more and more. By the way, as you know, the young people, especially among the females, are really moving towards plant-based diets, with Greta Thunberg pointing out how essential it is that we address climate change, and we have to bring that out, that over 40% of the ice-free area in this world is now used for grazing for animals and growing feed crops for animals. Because of that, it used to be 6 trillion trees, it's down now to 3 trillion, and therefore less carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is being sequestered or absorbed, so that it is now, the atmosphere carbon dioxide is up to 420 parts per million, way above the 350 parts per million that the climate experts say is like a threshold value for sustainability. Mm-hmm. So it's got to get that down. And the only way to do that is to reforest again the vast areas now used for animal agriculture. The tragedy is, I just saw this maybe a week or two ago, they are actually projecting a possible doubling of meat production by the middle of this century. It's like the world is committing suicide. We're eating ourselves to extinction. And we've got to get that message out. And I just started getting involved more and more. Foolishly put it off the air. But in terms of PowerPoints, so I'm making some PowerPoints on that, trying to reach out to more and more audiences on that.
That is frightening to think that there's a chance that the NEAT production could be doubling. But you mentioned the younger generation, and I agree. I feel like there is hope with them. They are so much more open to like exploring what we're doing wrong and getting in the forefront of that. And even when I think, so I don't have any kids, but I have some nieces and nephews, and they range from, 8 years old up to 23. From what I've seen, even things like, they have friends who come out to them as gay or non-binary, and it's not even an issue. The kids are just like, it doesn't change who you are to me or our relationship. And, 20 years ago, even when I was a kid, if someone came out, there was a chance that they weren't going to have those same friends anymore, and that their life at school was going to get very hard. And even these little shifts where they're able to see things the way that we'd done things in the past and go, we're not going to be the people who do it that way. And they're more open to trying to change things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that applies to food as well. And the way that we use others, other beings for our own convenience and for food and things. And so I too am inspired by that, but it's going to take more than that, right? Like people my age, people your age, like we've got to find that motivation across all of us. And whether it's because we have people, younger people in our lives, and we want a world to still exist for them, or even for those who want to take a completely selfish approach. Like you talked about how damaging eating animals is to our own bodies. So even if all you care about is you, there are still so many reasons to stop eating animals.
Problem is now, in many ways, been saying medical practice can be called malpractice if doctors don't tell the patients about the many health benefits of a plant-based vegan diet. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, we patients may not listen, but at least it's up to the doctors. But so many, I guess, because in the medical schools, they spend a minimum amount of time on this. Many nutritionists I've spoken to talk about a balanced diet, have some fruits, vegetables, but something is wrong in the education of nutritionists and doctors, other medical professionals, because as you know, there's so many studies out there that not only can plant-based diets prevent heart disease, various types of cancer, other life-threatening diseases, but in many cases, they can reverse them. And one of the things that I try to stress is that human beings are really much closer, to herbivorous animals than omnivorous. One of the slides I'm using, as I said in the PowerPoint, I'm starting to present, look at a human teeth and then compare that with a tiger or even a bear's teeth. Look at our hands and compare it to the claws. Mm-hmm. Our intestinal system is four times longer per unit height than that of a carnivorous or omnivorous animal. And our stomach acid is only 1/20. In other words, we are so far from that. So the bottom line is that we're closest to herbivorous animals, but most people have a diet closer to omnivorous animals. That is why, of course, there's like an epidemic of disease out there. And it's really shameful that doctors are not stressing this. And there's so many videos that have been made recently, films or pointing this out. So the information's out there, and just have to try to get it out more effectively.
Right, exactly. So how can we do that?
We have to start when kids are young. As you say, it's already the head start there that they realize it, but they know it's their future that's going to be involved. And again, bringing out the fact that so many species are in danger now, and one of them is the human species, really, because if this keeps increasing. By the way, just a couple of points. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, said the situation on climate change is a cold red for humanity. Mm. And he said the world is on a highway toward a climate hell. And he said, the final thing, that delay is death. In other words, we don't have that much time. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the most effective group on climate change, because intergovernmental, that means they have climate experts from many countries, have to be consensus devised. Every year, every few years, they issue increasing warnings. Now, they said in 2018, we may have only until 2030 to make quote-unquote unprecedented changes in order to, and by 2030, you don't have a chance to build a climate catastrophe. That was 2018. Since then, the atmospheric carbon dioxide has been increasing, and we're just not making the kind of progress that is essential for that. So we have to get the word out, up to the leaders more to stress it. And again, in the PowerPoint, I say, you know, that elephant in the room that's being ignored, or maybe more appropriately, it's a cow in the room. Because unless we realize we have to move away from that animal-based diet, and again, it's incredible. The Jewish holiday is Tu B'Shvat is coming up as we speak, and that is the birthday for trees. The Jewish tradition, the fate of the trees is judged on that day. But again, we've lost trillions of trees over the years, and if animal-based diets continue to increase, more and more forests being cut down, the Amazon, the lungs of the world, being destroyed, mainly for profit. Somebody said to save a nickel in a fast food hamburger, it's like 55 square feet of tropical rainforest is being destroyed for every quarter pound hamburger. Oh. So we can't give up hope, we can't despair, we have to do everything possible, and that's why I'm trying to do it. And my group, Jewish Veg, just came up with a major change with their website, and they're going to soon submit a vegan statement signed by 170 approximately rabbis. They're hoping to get up to 200, maybe releases then, so that things are happening. A lot of positive developments, many great videos being made. We're heading in the right direction, but will it be enough soon enough?
Right. I think part of the problem too is right that climate change, despite it being a people issue, has become this political fodder. People are led to believe that if you're on one side, especially here in the U.S., right, you're on one side, then climate change isn't real and you're stupid if you think so. And then on the other side, climate change is the catastrophe that the scientists are telling us and nobody will listen. What a disservice we are doing to ourselves and the planet and the future humans and animals that may exist or may not, depending on how quickly we get this under control. What a disservice we're doing by assigning it this political nature, when of course we need politics involved, because the system needs to be changed. The way that animals are caught up in the agriculture system has to change. And there are politics involved and things like that. But it's a human issue. It's a people issue. And each one of us has the power 3 times a day, right? At minimum.
Absolutely.
To make a different choice and make it a possibility for us to have a future for those younger generations and to not abuse animals the way we abuse them now.
I agree completely. It may be that there's just one political party in the world that is in denial, and that unfortunately the Republican Party in the U.S., which is kind of crazy. And of course, they are so indebted to the fossil fuel industries, for example. We now know that, for example, Exxon knew decades ago about the negative effects of their product in orbit. They hit it. It's an age of false statements and all. However, on the other hand, because there's been so many of these severe climate effects, especially in the summer of 2022, so many heat waves, so many floods, so I think people more and more are realizing that climate change is a threat. And hopefully, because this is what the science climate experts are saying, human activities are certainly a major, major factor behind this. We have to make a difference. It's the future of humanity is at stake, and we've got to get that message out much more effectively. We're moving in the right direction. Mm-hmm. I think the number of vegans is increasing, but all too slowly.
Right. Mm-hmm. So yeah, get the message out. Talk to as many people as we can. Work in areas where we can make a significant change. It's big, but if we're doing it together, like, we can make a significant impact on the world and life going forward. So climate change is one of your six reasons for going vegan. Mm-hmm. You want to talk about the other five?
Okay, absolutely. Again, taking care of our health, treating animals with compassion, protecting the environment, which includes climate change, conserving natural resources, helping hungry people, and pursuing peace. Okay, so very briefly, and all of them, again, there's so much evidence in peer-reviewed articles that animal-based diets are causing heart disease, cancer, many other life-threatening diseases, and many studies. There's Dr. Dean Ornish out in California who showed that you can not only prevent heart disease, you actually reverse it. He had people with severe cases. One person cannot cross the street without chest pains. And he had them on a very low-fat diet for a while, and meditation, and getting together and discussing things. And 82%, some of them with a hard kind of diet up now, reversed it. And because of that, insurance companies initially only would pay if it was surgery, if it was only drugs, but now reimbursing for that and realizing that's far better because that's a far more permanent thing. So we can reverse. I mean, there's one book with a breast cancer surgeon for 30 years who started saying, well, can we prevent it? He looked at all kinds of studies and found that the bottom line was it's the diet that is the factor on that. And we mentioned before that we are closer to herbivorous animals than carnivorous animals. And one of the problems there is that people say, well, how do I get enough protein? How do I get enough calcium? But that, of course, is a tremendous myth. They actually did experiments on rats, and a human's mother's milk, only 5 to 6% of the calories are in protein. A rat is about 47%. So that the issue should be not getting enough protein, but because most people get far too much animal protein, and it's a major problem for the kidneys. It's actually a major, probably the major cause of osteoporosis, because the excess protein acidifies the blood, and calcium is taken from the bones to buffer that, and that's excreted with the excess protein. As far as animals, it's incredible how horrendously animals are raised on factory farms. Just to give one quick example, say in the egg-laying hatcheries, males, 250 male chicks killed almost immediately because they can't lay eggs and they haven't been genetically programmed to have much flesh. So they are either ground up and maybe used for pet food or put in bags where they can suffocate or crush the ones below them. And the hens don't fare that much better. They are not killed, of course, right after birth like the males are, but they're put in cages so small that after a while they can't even raise a wing, and they peck at each other in their frustration, harming the other bird. So instead of giving more space, although it has increased a bit with the animal rights protest, but still the hands can't even raise one wing, and instead of increasing the distance and stop the harm from pecking, they do as they do, they de-beak them, cut them off. It's a very cruel process, no anesthesia, no painkiller, etc. on that. So again, these are very much against Jewish teachings, against the teachings of every religion, which is every religion based on compassion and mercy, etc. Well, the environment spoke to is not just climate change, but deforestation, soil erosion and depletion, animal species disappearing, and air pollution, water pollution, the pesticides, the fertilizer washing into the water, the animal waste, tremendous amounts washing into the water, terrible odors from the pig waste in many states in the U.S. And in terms of the conservation of resources, the animal-based diets are so much more wasteful. You need so much more land, more energy, more water, because the irrigation of the feed crops for the animals, it turns out, in the world getting more and more scarce of water, can take up to 13 times as much water on an animal-based diet than on a strictly plant-based diet. So, you know, when they talk about shortages of food, land, water, they usually forget again the cow in the room and the effect of animal-based agriculture. And in terms of hunger, we mentioned before, one of the reasons I became a vegetarian then a vegan is that animal-based diets are so wasteful. 70% grain, U.S., about 40% worldwide fed to animals to fatten them up. And what makes it far more, even far more scandalous, is that we take very healthy foods like corn and soy and oats, very high in complex carbohydrates and fiber, devoid completely of saturated fat and cholesterol, feed them to the animals, and we get just the opposite. So not only are we destroying the planet, but very negative effects on health and and again, on hunger. And my final thing was to seek and pursue peace, an important Jewish mandate. There was a dream of nations building their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks and all. And the Jewish sages saw, it turns out the word for bread in Hebrew is lechem, and the word for war, milchama, they come from the same root. And the sages deduce when there's a shortage of grain and other resources, people are more likely to go to war. You know, when there's more than enough for everybody, so they're getting more than their share, well, but we still have enough. But when there are shortages, we've seen that, of course, in history. In biblical times, there were battles over water at the wells, more recently over oil. And so the animal-based diets lead to shortages of grain and other resources make violence, terrorism, war more likely. So it's come up with, some may consider a terrible pun, that the slogan of the peace movement and the animal rights, vegetarian and vegan movements should be one and the same. Same slogan. And from John Lennon, all we're saying is give peas a chance. We need peas on earth, and we can get that through vegan diet. And in addition, of course, the climate change, as we indicated, which is very much caused by animal-based diets, is going to lead to, according to the military, tens of millions of desperate, hungry refugees fleeing from the droughts, the wildfires, the heat waves, the storms, the floods, and that makes the violence and war far more likely. So a quick summary, and I hope people go to my website, by the way, to get more information, look at my books, and trying to make them available. As I said, be happy to make that one of my recent books, Vegan Revolution, Saving Our World, and Revitalizing Judaism, available to anybody who emails me at veggierich@gmail.com. That's VEGGIE rich@gmail.com. And again, happy to get that out. I want to get that in PDF form to as many people as possible.
Thank you. The link to your email will be in the show notes. People can click right into it and send you a message. And thank you for being willing and wanting to share your latest book to anyone who asks for it. I just want to go back quickly. When you were talking about resources and how many resources land and water raising animals uses, I thought back to, do you remember, it was only just a couple of years ago where it was like a big stink that growing almonds in California was the reason why Californians didn't have any water, because almonds take so much water to grow. Nobody was talking about the amount of water used in raising animals, because they don't want to hear it, I guess. It doesn't, there's no huge almond subsidy out there. It's so frustrating.
Those subsidies reduced the price of meat. People had to pay the full price with the environmental impact, the health costs, and all, then it would be far beyond the means of most people, other than the very wealthy. But unfortunately, we all pay a price for that. Health costs are soaring, and the environmental costs, and again, the entire world being threatened by climate change. And people have to realize, as I cow in the room, that the important cause is the animal-based agriculture.
Let's talk about your book a little bit. Tell me about the vegan revolution within the book.
Okay, well, again, let's say there's a vegan revolution, and of course, here in Israel especially, it's considered one of the vegan capitals. Young people are moving in that direction, especially among the females and all. And there's been a revolution in the sense that there's been an explosion of plant-based substitutes. So things are moving in that direction. And again, the subtitle, Saving Our World, again, it's essential that, as we've been talking about, there'd be a big increase in vegan consumption. And revitalizing Judaism, because, again, we have these powerful teachings, but people are overlooking it. Again, there are rabbis, certainly many people know a lot more about Judaism than I do, but they're ignoring, in that cow in the room, that the really six mandates that are being violated. And many Jews are careful about other things, very commendably, but they're missing out that every time they have an animal-based meal, they are violating Jewish teachings on compassion for animals, taking care of our health, protecting the environment, things we mentioned regard to hunger and resources and violence, et cetera, et cetera. So again, this is what we need to do. We're moving in the right direction, and hopefully the momentum will continue, and maybe we'll hit a tipping point where people see so many vegans around them. And as you know, there are more and more vegan restaurants, and as far as I know, even places like Burger King, others are moving in that direction. And the restaurants, even when they're meat-based, all now seem to have several vegan options indicated clearly on their menu. So momentum is on our side. Let's hope it continues and makes a difference.
Yeah. One of the things in your book that really stood out to me was how much easier it is to be kosher when you're vegan, and mm-hmm. how it can save you money, it can save you time. Right, there's that time where you have to wait between eating the meat and the dairy. But even you don't need all those separate pots, pans, plates. Right. So talk a little bit about that. How is that easier for any potential listeners who are keeping a kosher kitchen, or so they think right now?
Okay. Well, again, Judaism has the kosher laws. Certain animals you can't eat, etc. Animals have to be slaughtered in a certain way, with a minimum of pain, et cetera. But there's always a chance, especially with mass production nowadays, that can go wrong and the animal is not strictly kosher. And there's always a chance, as you mentioned, hint, mix meat and milk, you have to wait a certain amount of hours, and many people have separate sinks, which helps and all, but there's always a chance of that going wrong. Also, there's been many scandals in the meat inspection industry, you know, when money is involved and you realize an inspector can't be on site every single minute. And many of them, they've had many articles about scandals here where they have inspectors chosen more because they're relatives of the people who choose it. And some of them, if you looked at their records, they'd have to work more than 24 hours a day to do all the inspections that they have been done. So it's much easier with fruits and vegetables and all to be kosher on that. So people are very committed, want to be kosher, but why take a chance when things can go wrong, when the inspector might not have really been inspecting that much, especially, as I said, when so much money is involved in the billion-dollar kosher industry.
Another thing, too, is I want to talk about kind of, so you're in Israel, and has there been kind of, how is the vegan, what's the vegan movement like there?
Okay, well, they say that a higher percentage of vegans in Israel than most countries, and maybe one or two even more, and especially in Tel Aviv, especially many young people, there's an abundance of vegan restaurants, and more and more people moving in that direction. And Israel is one of the pioneers in the plant-based substitute industry. They are also pioneers in something with technology, getting actual meat from the cells of animals. Mm-hmm. That wouldn't simply be vegan, but certainly it would cut down on the need for vast areas for raising cattle and cut down on the animal abuses and all. So would be a positive step. We're not 100% vegan, and hopefully that would, again, people can get their texture, appearance, taste now from plant-based substitutes, possibly in a few years from that, what they call cultured meat, from just the cells of the animal. So a lot of experimentation going on in that. They say Israel is a pioneer, I think, in some areas just behind the U.S., which is number one in plant-based substitutes and in cultured meat production.
Okay. I also noticed, that you mentioned that the Israel Defense Forces, they don't just provide vegan meals for vegan soldiers. They also have boots, hats, and belts that they provide in their uniforms. That's amazing.
Okay, yeah, that's a step forward, because Israel being one of the vegan centers of the world. So that is a very, very positive thing. They just had a change in a new chief of staff of the Israeli Defense Forces. But the previous one, Amir Kohavi, was a vegan, the head of all of the Israeli Defense Forces being a vegan. And you know, within Judaism, the fact that we do, as we mentioned, have the kosher laws. So Jews are used to looking at, you know, food and what are the ingredients. So that's sort of a head start. And that may be why such a relatively high percent of Israelis are vegan. But certainly far, far more needs to be done.
You make a good point there, because for sure, you know, in America, where we have so many processed things, our grocery stores are enormous. There's boxes and boxes of stuff with ingredient lists this long. People don't read the ingredients. It's not a common practice for the average American. They just know, I like this one, and that's what I'm going to buy. So learning to read labels is really important. So for any of the Jewish listeners out there, like, you guys already have a head start on this. So now it's a lot easier to go vegan. You already know how to read labels. You already know what you're, so now you just have to learn some new ingredients that you have to keep an eye out for, and and don't buy the those products. But I love that. This, like, we look at things, like, I would never have thought about that, even knowing that people keep kosher and they have to be mindful of what they're eating, what they're buying. It didn't even occur to me, hey, this is a perk for you to go vegan. You're already ready and doing some of the things that we're doing. We're always reading labels and checking things like that. So you're already halfway there.
Also, to help for those who don't have the time to read the labels or whatever, there's a new group called Vegan Friendly. Yeah. And many products have on them a little heart shaped thing that you see that, you know, it's vegan. And I just heard not that long ago, this is now coming to the US. So when you have that symbol, and people are used to looking, if not everybody keeps kosher, but for those that do, there's always kosher symbols. So now there's one other thing that Vegan Friendly can help know. And again, so many plant-based positive, everything under the sun, from salmon and chicken and eggs. Certainly, by the way, as you know, we have soy milk and almond milk and rice milk. So we can get away from the horrible, horrible cruelty of the dairy industry by having these things. As you know, that cow's milk was meant for the calf. To raise that calf in a short time, tremendous increase in weight. And as you know, also many people are lactose intolerant because, you know, it's just not natural. Humans are the only species that takes milk from another species and also takes it beyond a weaning period. So very unnatural. And one of the factors on that is, of course, it's so unnatural. The age of puberty for young ladies has been decreasing very sharply. Many areas used to be like 16, maybe down to 12, and many cases. Imagine a girl at 10 being having periods and all, and certainly not emotionally ready to have a baby and all. And you know, for those against abortion, that is a factor there too that could reduce the abortion rate by trying maybe to stop that trend. Mm-hmm. Age of puberty has been decreasing for many, many years.
Yeah. And then, you know, this might be too TMI for some listeners, but I was one of those young kids. It was only a couple months before my 10th birthday when I got my first period. And it also, the younger you start that process, the less time you have as an adult to actually, you know, be able to have children. And, you know, many of us that get our periods that young are much more likely to have an early menopause. So it doesn't just, we're too immature at 10, of course, to have our own children. And then it has an impact later on in life. And who knows what else that can lead to, you know, as we get older and move into, you know, that the final stages of our lives.
Absolutely. So, yeah. And because of that early getting the first period and later, we're at the end of the period, menopause. So there's a much longer period between puberty and menopause. And that means that there's much more estrogen that is going to be a part of the diet. And that is a very big risk factor for breast cancer and probably other problems. So it's such an unnatural diet for people, and it's having its very negative health effects.
Mm-hmm. You know what's really interesting and really speaks to this addiction that we have with milk and cheese is that so many people, when they find out that I eat tofu regularly, are like, aren't you worried about the breast cancer risk of the estrogen from tofu? But they don't want to talk about or even are aware of estrogen in dairy. It's not even a thought. Everyone's so, I can't eat tofu because it'll put me at risk for breast cancer. No. All that cheese and glasses of milk you're downing, cow's milk that you're downing, that's where the issue is.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But, you know, it's hard because it is such an addictive food. Right. And of course it is, because the whole reason for cow's milk and human breast milk and rat's milk is that the baby is interested in eating so that the baby has a better chance of surviving. So it has to have some kind of addictive quality to it. But as you pointed out, once we're not babies anymore, we're not supposed to be consuming milk anyway. But since we've made it a thing, we have all these wonderful nuts and seeds that we'll make, that we can make milk out of. Mm-hmm. So if we need it, we've got to have milk for whatever reason. And I use milk all the time. The favorite here is like oat milk and soy milk. Those are the mm-hmm. two we always have in the house. But I mean, there's cashew and rice milk and whatever mm-hmm. texture you're used to from your cow's milk. There's a plant version that will get you that same texture. The flavors are wonderful. And it's so versatile. You can use it in baking and cooking and just drinking by the glass. Like, there's nothing to miss out on by releasing the cruelty and you know, the animal products in your diet. You know, you've said multiple times about all of the different substitutes that we have now. Like, there's no reason anymore to still eat animals. There just isn't. Not one. Yeah.
Well, I agree 100%. And kudos to you having this podcast and continuing and hopefully reaching more and more people and getting that essential message out.
I hope so. Yeah, thank you. I mean, that's the whole point, right? That's why I start off every podcast episode asking to hear your vegan journey, because I want my listeners, which, by the way, most of them are not vegan, which is really nice because mm-hmm. we're reaching the right audience then. But mm-hmm. I want them to hear a story, you mm-hmm. know, and relate to it. They'll hear themselves in your journey, in my journey, in all the other guests, and go, they did it. I can do it too. Mm-hmm. And then to know that the support, like, all of us have so many different ways that we can support people who are ready to go vegan, ready to embrace this lifestyle and move from a space of cruelty and sadness and destruction into something really beautiful and wonderful and in alignment with religions and just this peace and justice movement that we are a part of. Veganism is a part of that, and it's so important. And I'm so thankful that you're here with me today, and the books you've written and the education that you provide every time you speak with someone about veganism and how we can make this world a safer, kinder, better place. I have one final question for you, Richard. Tell us about your favorite hummus or your favorite way to eat hummus.
Well, every single day I have a wonderful lunch. And I have so many valuable things and all, you know, and it's just amazing taste, because in addition to the hummus, I have lemon juice and scallions and avocados and all kinds of vegetables. And again, you know, this can make such a difference, and you can mix and match all different things. And the hummus makes a great difference. Very often I have it separately with rice cakes or something. So very, very happy that I have this kind of product. By the way, members of my family sometimes make their own, so it's even healthier than the store-bought kind. But once again, the bottom line is that by being a vegan, you're not sacrificing taste at all. There are so many things, and people tell me, you know, I was in this place and I went to the vegan, they're not vegan or anything like it, but they went to the vegan restaurant, and surprised at how the great taste that there can be there. So it's just a matter of having more and more than have that wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
But many thanks for this opportunity, and I hope it helps and makes a difference, and many people see it and share it.
Thank you. Yeah, I know that what you've shared today will definitely have an impact on the listeners. And I know that I appreciate you being here and everything that you do. Thank you so much, Richard.
Okay, well, thank you for the opportunity. And once again, best wishes for success, because what you're doing is the most important thing that anybody can do in terms of trying to save the world and have a decent, habitable, environmental, sustainable world for future generations. So many, many thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
All the best.
Welcome back. What a great conversation. Here are the six Jewish mandates Richard discussed. 1. Take care of our health. 2. Treat animals with compassion. 3. Conserve natural resources. 4. Protect the environment. 5. Help the hungry. And 6. Pursue peace. Which one will you learn about first? I can't wait to find out. To connect with Richard and to request a PDF of his latest book, Vegan Revolution, email him at veggierich@gmail.com. You can find a collection of his works at jewishveg.org/Schwartz. Follow Jewish Veg on Facebook and Instagram. All of the links, of course, can be found in the show notes. I hope you found this episode helpful and inspiring. Please subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And if you're loving it, please give Did You Bring the Hummus a 5-star rating. It's an easy way to keep supporting the show. You're also invited to join my free private Facebook group for fans of the show. You can find the link in the show notes. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram at Did You Bring the Hummus, and visit my website, didyoubringthehummus.com, for more information about me, updates on what I'm working on, new podcast episodes, and all things vegan. Finally, I would love to hear from you. What do you need help with? Is there a topic you want to hear covered on a future episode? DM me on Instagram or send me an email at didyoubringthehummus@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.